Welcome to a new episode of Becoming a Post-Growth Planner, Obstacles and Challenges to Changing Roles and Practices. My name is Christian Lamker, Assistant Professor at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. We are now in March 2026 and nearing the 10th anniversary of the German concept of post-growth planning. And therefore, it is really a special honor for me to welcome Anitra Nelson from the University of Melbourne in Australia, who is among the leading experts in the field for much longer than I have any knowledge about that.
Yes, and thank you very much for chatting with me, Christian. I'm an activist scholar, which means that I do things that I think about and research. I'm affiliated with the Informal Urbanism Research Hub at University of Melbourne. And before that, I was at the Centre for Urban Research at RMIT University and did quite a lot of research projects for the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute, as well as being involved as an activist and as a scholar in degrowth.
Thank you. I think that's also the connection where we met each other first around 2015 when I've been in Melbourne.
Indeed.
Now we are in 2025, and you've recently edited last year the Routledge Handbook of Degrowth. What brought you to that, and why especially now?
Well, look, in actual fact, I didn't go looking for a publisher with the idea. Annabel Harris, who's the editor for Sustainability and Environment at Routledge, actually contacted me, and she said, "Would you be prepared to have a chat with me about the idea of editing a Routledge Handbook of Degrowth?" So that's how it all started. And after I'd made a proposal to Routledge with a kind of indicative contents page, I also went to Vincent Ligy, who I've co-written and co-edited things with before, and he was prepared to come on the editorial team with me and was basically like an editorial advisor going over everything that we had in terms of reviewing chapters and that kind of thing.
Yeah, we will get into some topics more in the coming half an hour or so. But since we first met in Melbourne 2015, housing has been really deeply nested within your thinking. You have already mentioned that in your introduction. And in our talk before, you have also expressed that the horizontalism is quite crucial to you. Can you first explain what you mean by horizontalism?
Yes. And it's quite interesting because I, Terry Lay, and Vincent Ligy have co-written a post on this topic, which is came out on the 20th of March. And there we discuss the rich tradition, the significance of holistic, horizontalist, philosophical, cultural, and political approaches within the degrowth movement. So that's at degrowth.info. Now, the term horizontalism, it sort of develops from horizon, a flat line level, in contrast to hierarchical or vertical structures. So horizontalists are anti-hierarchy, anti-capitalist, decolonial, and pluriversal. Post-capitalist visions, strategies, and ways of relating with one another and Earth, that's nature, are horizontal in this perspective. There are equitable and respectful relationships. And so in that article that I've co-written, we refer to a document which was created well over 15 years ago by a French group who produced Degrowth, a platform for convergence, and they highlighted a strategy of the snail, rejecting seizing power and exerting power over. And instead, they argued to create without delay the conditions which will enable us to give full meaning to our lives. I've just quoted that. But these are the types of horizontalist approaches that have been implicit and explicit in degrowth. And they highlight autonomy, substantive and direct democracy, and grassroots organizing. So that's what I mean about horizontalism.
How does this horizontalism, in your view, change the current spatial and planning policies that we have in place?
Well, the current planning and spatial policies generally exemplify hierarchies because they serve markets and capitalist governments. For instance, here in Australia, the federal government indicates universal policies for Australian housing and planning futures. And then the state governments are expected to turn these into guidelines, or these guidelines into regulations and legislation for their territories. And at a municipal level, planners are just expected to apply those rules locally. In contrast, we see horizontalism as encouraging everyone to contribute to collective decision making, say in assemblies and working groups. And so horizontalist degrowth envisages a lot of collective provisioning as locally as possible while we develop caring, nurturing, and regenerative practices with earth. So as part of a transition, we would actually think that you could usefully ask governments to adopt what we call enabling policies. And those are kind of policies that enable grassroots action.
What would you say, where are then the major obstacles to overcome the hierarchical mode of decision-making you mentioned, from national down to local level, or the more bureaucratic ways of organizing?
Yeah, well, in horizontalism, as I said, planning involves everyone. These kind of horizontalist practices became more visible in the global north in the 1960s and 70s with protests and activism, perhaps most obviously in consciousness-raising circles and everyday organising of the second wave women's liberation movements. So it's a really organic approach, treating everyone as worthy of a voice, learning to listen and hear single testimonies through to multiple voices, standing one's ground in a forum while holding hands with others of different opinions, deliberating in assemblies and through open proposals, debates and revisions, weaving consensus, developing freewheeling but accountable working groups, emerging from and reporting to assemblies. So the kind of overly technical and hierarchical approaches don't really fit in. And so I see a lot of work necessary to highlight that planning is political, and it's political now in supporting markets and capitalist governments, but to show that planning could operate very differently. And so there are participatory approaches to planning that introduce higher horizontalist practices and will might be a transitional way forward. And I'm thinking here of things like citizens' assemblies, which have sometimes been experimented with in planning contexts.
Yeah, I certainly agree that planning can be done differently. And in terms of citizens' assemblies, it's quite interesting that only last Friday I saw a study how many of them are actually in place. The other question is what the outcome in reality at the end is, but it's definitely more than an experiment already.
This is the case. There have been a lot of problems getting governments to actually then act on the recommendations of citizens' assemblies. But the really vital thing is, I think it shows that the citizens' assemblies themselves can come out with very useful kinds of recommendations. They can organise themselves, they can come to some kind of form of consensus, and that this is really, really useful.
So then let's move a step further, or back, you could say, into the questions of housing. How can degrowth, horizontalism, maybe also citizen assemblies, help us move forward towards more decent housing for everyone?
Well, in Housing for Degrowth, that's a collection that Francois Schneider and I edited, There are some wonderful chapters by researchers showing housing in various parts of the world that are at the forefront of downsizing homes, meeting basic needs for shelter in a variety of ways, and planning differently. So one chapter is by Hans Widmer, who, and it seems quite utopian because it has neighbourhoods as the basic module of an entire global commons. But with friends, Widmer has actually gone on to use Zurich's cooperative housing model, supported by the City Council, to show how these forms of ecological housing are a way of the future. And his most recent work with some of those friends came out last year from Autonomedia, which is a publishing house in New York. And it's called Cities for a Single Planet, a model for the ecological transformation of the earth. I strongly recommend reading it because it's got lots of examples of different experiments that are happening right through the world. But in our actual collection, we drew on that concept that I introduced a few minutes ago of enabling policies. And we also talked very much about how planning relies on changes in the rest of society, not just changes in planning. So, like in terms of the top-down policy meeting grassroots efforts as enabling policies, our recommendations have included revising planning and building application processes to enable simple self-build dwellings and collective land settlements like eco-collaborative housing. Also enhancing social housing with sustainable renovations to preserve history and conserve nature. And applying maximum standards, for instance, in space per capita rather than minimum ones, as is common nowadays. Also flexibly applying planning conditions along taking sort of account of ecological and affordable criteria. And what we see is that we can't really provide housing justice and have these principles of housing sufficiency unless work is changing and people have more time to be involved in collective activities. So deeper democracy being taken on board by governments and aspects of deurbanization, all these kinds of things, in order for us to move to a different degrowth, post-growth kind of world, we need to be working with markets and with governments to transition.
Yeah, I certainly agree that the transition is a key issue, how to get from where we are to where we might want to be, and then also intertwine that with the tools that we can envision and have available. And it's quite fascinating for me how you have dealt with housing also over a long time. I recently reread into the chapter with Paul Chatterton in 2022 on dwelling beyond growth. And you asked the question there, how might we dwell, live and house ourselves in a post-growth world? And part of the answer for you is also eco-collaborative housing. What do you see as the key role of eco-collaborative communities, local collective provisioning in such a transition?
Yes, so in that chapter, Paul and I drew on our respective experiences living in eco-collaborative housing communities, intentional collective housing where each household has a private space but a lot of common areas inside and outside, for instance, for dining inside and gardening outside. Like other researchers and activists, we see these as models like halfway points capable of being established in the here and now, but also with characteristics of shared living with smaller ecological footprints and a very convivial, sharing and caring social environment. Paul drew on his experience of Lilac co-housing, which has been established in Leeds, and I drew on visiting and interviewing some new generation young housing cooperatives models in Zurich that Hans Widmer has been so involved with, and I mentioned his recent book before. So Paul and I discussed how these models relied on struggling with the local city council planning and housing bodies, or in the Zurich case, they actually were supported by the Zurich council policies and institutions. We also outlined how eco-collaborative communities both enable and encourage more collective ways of living, and we outlined their potential for operating community-supported agricultural activities, community-based gardens, and breaking down the mentalities associated with private properties and individualized apartments and so on. So, for instance, many of what I call best practice eco-collaborative communities are outer-directed, and they have outreach activities, and they have, for instance, on their ground floor, they might have a big area which they ask invite neighbours to come in and use for collective activities, that kind of thing.
A step further from there, is there also a role, or what is it, for self-building, for renovation in the quest towards post-growth futures for you?
Yes. In fact, in Housing for Degrowth, we've actually got several examples of self-building, also of customized, ecologically sustainable homes that are guided by architects and builders, but who invite the owners to come in and work alongside them. And Mara Ferrari has a chapter on refurbishing social housing, marked for demolition, as a housing campaign. But the self-building examples include, we looked at how people self-build in traditional ways in Vanuatu, which is a collection of dozens and dozens of islands as a nation. We have a chapter by Ted Trainer, who has a demonstration project showing really simple ways to build houses, small houses, and that's in Sydney, in one of the capital cities of Australia. There's a chapter by an architect speaking about South India, and also people who themselves have self-built, for instance, a low-impact home in the Yarmouth eco-village in Wales, and another a roundhouse in Lower Saxony in Germany. And some of the common things about that self-building is reusing materials, using materials that can actually be recycled, doing the work on the house collectively, and respecting the craft in the way that these homes are built, and thinking very much about ecologically sound design.
Thanks. Yeah, I would like to open it up a bit, or move beyond these examples to then the wider question of urban-rural, or the role of cities. As a crucial work for me is still your book, Small is Necessary, Shared Living on a Shared Planet, from 2017. But shared living has frictions, especially with the way when we talk and develop cities. What do you see of the role or the conflicts of connecting cities to degrowth?
Yes, well, I think cities are really a big problem now, mainly because of their size. I see them problematic because they become like social bubbles where children brought up in cities don't really have a strong connection with Earth, and in a sense they're caged in that city. And some Indigenous people in particular have referred to cities as cancers. They're like overgrowth. So I'd really like cities to become more self-provisioning, and for settlements to spread out in decentralized ways. And how I see this kind of happening is that where you have empty blocks or you have housing that really does need to be demolished, that actually becomes space where things could be grown. I'm not thinking about spreading settlements in like sprawling suburbs, but more like dense small townships that are surrounded by areas for collective self-provisioning for food and for build the inputs for buildings and so on. So looking at permaculture and agroecology practices like diverse multi-cropping, small animal husbandry, as well as obtaining wood through ecoforestry. And this is where I think eco-collaborative communities come in. They're like showcases, demonstration cases, they're transitionary modes for developing collective provisioning. And there are lots of ways that craft and industrial cooperatives can be collected, co-located, you know, with their agrarian and mineral inputs in this way as well.
Yeah.
So I really argue for decentralization.
Decentralization on the one side, on the other side, it's still a massive question of scale to think from singular examples in different places, urban, rural, here and elsewhere, towards then wider changes, wider socio-spatial changes. Where do you see the most promising trajectories to really shape the futures beyond the singular examples?
Well, one of the interesting facts is that some of these kinds of prefigurative degrowth activities that are trying to prefigure, to model futures that would be more sustainable and convivial, are actually based in cities. So Kargonomia in Budapest is a good example of this, although they linked to a farm which is on the peri-urban edge of Budapest, but you can actually get there on public transport. So prefigurative activities such as there's community-based gardens, community-supported agriculture, bike and garden tool libraries, like makeries of bikes and garden tools and clothing, they can all start in cities or in rural areas as examples that people can observe, they can experience, become involved with, but they can also replicate them. So what we're looking at is duplicating rather than expanding as the way massive companies do, for instance. I suppose they're a little bit like, if in a capitalist sense, franchises. They're copies. So it's a matter, I see, of scaling up through producing a lot of smaller, communally sufficient enterprises, duplicating the best examples of them and the best practices, but they'll always be customized to their environment and their potentials. They'll always be unique, which is different from the ordinary kind of franchise. And in the same way, I see that the more citizens' assemblies are really important, so that all the time we're developing our skills in being more democratic as well as being more caring and self-provisioning in a collective way. So citizens' assemblies are great because they integrate all kinds of people of different ages and stages of life and from various work experiences and professions. And I see these as places that could, as assemblies which can be looking at these kinds of experiments, prefigurative experiments, and planning how they could be supported and enabled in their own cities or rural areas.
Thank you. Yeah, we started already beginning to talk about the Routledge Handbook of Degrowth. And in, if I look into the final chapter, you speak in a particular to engage researchers like we are also. What are the critical questions we should foster in spatial planning research then?
Well, I I envisage engaged researchers, and I know of engaged researchers, and they're very creative people. And they ask questions like, who are we planning for? Who benefits from our planning? How might we plan for more equitable cities and rural areas? How might we plan for more sharing and caring and commoning? How can we integrate as many people into planning as we can in the here and now? Where are examples of degrowth and post-growth activities in practice? And they ask questions like, can we adopt or adapt some of these kinds of activities? How might we become more engaged with politicians to discuss changes for a future that's sustainable and convivial? And while politicians can be barriers, they can also open gates and promote people thinking and acting more progressively on the basis that they're kind of out there promising better futures for our children. So that's what I mean by engaged researchers and planners. And they can be people who are acting quite professionally and really doing a good job in this kind of engagement with local citizens and politicians.
Yeah, Anitra, many questions, many motivation also to take forward to planning practitioners, especially also planning researchers, politicians, and different actors, stakeholders that have a role to play and have something to say and that can enable something different to happen. Now we have talked for almost half an hour. So we move towards the end of this podcast episode, this recording. And as usual, the very final line is that I would like to ask you to contribute to the whole series in the search for a common definition and outlook. To finish the sentence for me, post-growth planning is?
Post-growth planning
is
opening a debate and action on a social and material transformation to more equitable and just relations between us and between us with Earth.
Thanks, Anitra Nelson. Thanks very much for joining me today to talk about your experience. We are quite a couple of hours away in different time zones. So thanks for making this possible.
Thank you. Thank you very much.